Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. As we gear up for the first ever TWIML Fest Virtual AI Festival, it's about time that we share a little bit more detail on a few of the many exciting things we've got in store for you. Join us in October for a full range of interactive sessions focused on learning and exploring, including The Road to Gold, Lessons from Kaggle Grandmasters, ML in the Fight Against Climate Change, Machine Learning for Sustainable Agriculture, and many more informative sessions, as well as interactive office hours and Ask Me Anything sessions with past guests of the podcast on topics like language models and natural language processing, reinforcement learning, and more. A collaborative TWIML Fest generative art installation, and a virtual film fest featuring the Coded Bias documentary starring Joy Bulamwini and directed by Shalini Kantaya. We also want to make sure that there's time to de-stress, so be sure to join us for virtual pub-style trivia, a comedy show in collaboration with Sing You Hilarity, and wellness activities like meditation and yoga. We'll have a lot more details coming your way in the next few weeks, so if you haven't already registered, be sure to check out twimlfest.com to stay up to date. The event takes place October 13th through the 30th, is totally free, and your registration ensures that you'll be among the very first to hear about important updates, giveaways, and announcements. TWIML Fest is all about community, so we want to hear your session ideas as well. Head over to twimlfest.com to check out how you can be involved in and host a session of your own. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone, I am here with Artur Yakimovich. Artur is co-founder at Artificial Intelligence for Life Sciences and a visiting scientist in the Lab for Molecular Cell Biology at University College London. Artur, welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast.
Hello, Sam. It's a pleasure.
It's great to have you on the show, and I'm looking forward to our chat. You know, let's get started with a little bit about your background. You are very active in trying to bring these two streams together, AI and life sciences. You know, what's the origin of that interest?
That's a great question. My entire background is essentially highly interdisciplinary. I did my undergrad in chemistry. Then I decided that I'm very interested to learn where does chemistry stop and biology starts. So I went on to do a PhD in virology and computational biology. And computers and computer science was always a great interest for me. And I was always thinking about, well, could we probably do more and better in biology in general and spearhead the discovery if we use a little bit more computers there. So after finishing my PhD, I did a short postdoc at a university hospital in Zurich. I was working in the Department of Microbiology, working on bacteria and computer vision algorithms. And after that, I moved on to do another longer postdoc at University College London, the postdoc I just recently finalized.
Cool. And you said something interesting in there. You wanted to see where chemistry stopped and biology finished, and that led you to studying viruses. What about viruses kind of characterizes that edge, unlike any other number of biological processes that are also fundamentally chemical?
That's a great question. Thanks. So, in principle, there is a big philosophical discussion whether viruses are dead or alive. Mm. I think personally, and that might start a huge conversation in the follow up of the show. But I think personally that they are undead. So
undead. As absolutely. In vampires and zombies and the like?
Well, think about that. Viruses technically are alive only once they are inside of a host cell. So at any time between that, they don't show any signs of being alive. So mm-hmm. in that sense, they can't be classified as either alive or dead at any time, apart from any specific circumstances.
Mm-hmm. But they're different from other compounds, and that once they are inside of a host, they start to do things that we associate with being alive, like reproduce and metabolize and all these other things. Absolutely. So they're not like some inert catalyst.
Exactly. Yeah. And they are very complex systems that are able to self-replicate and go on with their lives for only that long as the host is alive.
I mentioned you're co-founder of an organization, Artificial Intelligence for Life Sciences. It sounds like it's a consortium is probably not the right word, but it's an organization along those lines, and that you're trying to bring folks together and start conversations. Tell us a little bit more about what you're up to there and your goals.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot. So the Artificial Intelligence for Life Sciences is essentially just a platform bringing together people from life sciences, academics, and anyone who is interested in life sciences in any way, and bringing
you say
people...
platform like Facebook, or...
We use multiple...
Not a technology platform, just an organizational platform.
More like a organizational platform. We simply bring people together and provide them with a simple forum, an exchange of data, a chat where they can exchange opinions and ask for some technical help or maybe some clarifications and stuff like that. So our main page, if you look at it, essentially is a forum. Where we try to discuss things, do journal clubs, look at papers, share code, share solutions, and so on. So the organization itself is aimed as a community interest company, a non-for-profit organization. And the core idea behind it is essentially to bridge the massive divide that exists between life sciences and computer science or artificial intelligence. And the divide is constantly growing. And as AI progresses, things become more and more difficult to get into. And we're trying to kind of bring the value that advanced AI can give to life sciences and to scientific discovery.
And why is it that you think that AI gets more difficult to get into for folks in the life sciences? It seems like as the field progresses, you know, different approaches become commoditized, the tools are becoming commoditized, and the barriers to entry in a lot of ways are falling.
That certainly is the case. However, let's say many problems that are getting commoditized are still not the same problems that life sciences is looking on. In life sciences, you quite often try to do things in a little bit more of a broader fashion, where you try to bring in several methods showing the same thing. Whereas in computer science, you quite often try to look at the same problem over and over and over again, using a variation of you define those canonical problems like facial recognition and semantic segmentation and so on and so on. Whereas in life sciences, you're trying to bring all sorts of different kinds of data, DNA sequencing, bioimaging, electron microscopy, this kind of things, in order to kind of show the represented problem from a multifaceted view. So in this sense, it's a quite a different way of thinking about these problems. And although certain methodologies get more and more commoditized, as they do so, they certainly become less difficult to apply to the same problem and more difficult to apply to new problems.
I've had a number of conversations with folks on the podcast in the life sciences, and a lot of them they've been fairly varied, but a good number of them have been focused on microscopy data. And I think that aligns with just the point you were raising, that we've made so much progress in computer vision recently. Is that one of the fields or problems that you've been working in?
Yeah, absolutely. So the microscopy is... And biomedical imaging in general is sort of a pinnacle of the entire quantitative biology, and the way it's moving forward is one of the most sort of digitalized sources of biological data And obviously working with images is getting increasingly more and more easier. Like, I wouldn't say easier, probably easy is the wrong word. It's getting, you're getting a bigger tool set to work with images every day.
Drill into that distinction. You've certainly got a lot of tools, but hopefully the impact of all of these new tools is that they make things easier, but you're not quite ready to say that yet.
Yeah, I think quite often it's a little bit of hidden again on the same point that you raised before. As we progress with things like AutoML and things getting easier and more commoditized, suddenly you don't even know anymore what is it that you're looking for. Are you looking for image classifier? Are you looking for a segmentation? And there's awful loads you need to know about overall image analysis and all these kinds of problems history. Sort of, if you will, and computer science background to move it from the idea or an actual biological problem to a computational problem that is then going to be solvable by those commoditized tools.
We'll come back to kind of some of the broader life sciences issues, but let's maybe talk a little bit about your particular research interests. You know, what did you do for your postdoc, and what are some of the things that you do in your current role?
So in my postdoc, I worked in combining deep learning with microscopy, quite specifically super resolution microscopy of viruses. So virus particles were like one of the tricky things about viruses altogether is perhaps one of the only thing that they have in common is that they are called viruses. they're quite different entities altogether, depending on the kind of virus. They may be comprised of RNA, they may be comprised of DNA, they may be large, they may be small. Their size can vary between microns and nanometers. So like, probably the smallest one is around 20, 30 nanometers. So it's a vast, huge field with things being very, very fragmented in multiple subfields. So again, that's coming back to the problem of making things more applicable for computer science methodology, right? If it's certainly not a great idea to have a lot of small data sets rather than one huge data set helping to solve one big problem. Mm-hmm. So in one of the projects I worked in several papers, in one of the projects I've recently published, we managed to sort of explore the space of super-resolved virus particles of so-called vaccinia virus. It's a pox virus family.
And what's the virus name?
Vaccinia virus. It's the virus that was used as a live vaccine for eradication of smallpox.
Okay.
In this work, we used a set of different relatively advanced or let's say you could say state-of-the-art neural net architectures for image analysis and image classification to solve a number of day-to-day problems virologists face with their data. For example, if you've got a micrograph of a cell infected by a virus, how do you tell whether these tiny little dots that look like kind of stars are inside of the cell or outside of the cell? And that's in three-dimensional space. So in a biological sense, what we managed to show was that you can use advanced neural networks to pick this minute signals, alterations that occur once the virus is crossing the cellular membrane, so that you could tell that from the virus micrographs by themselves. And one of the interesting sort of tricks we managed to use in this case, and that's advocating for using deep learning for viruses specifically, is that we've been multiplexing the number of data points through the fact that you would have multiple viruses per one single cell. And since quite often in microscopy, the fixed magnification is way more suitable for cellular size than a virus, single virus size, you get way more virus particles in your data set from one single cell. And that allowed us to, you know, use more advanced neural nets. And additionally to that, we developed a trick we called mimicry embedding, which essentially repurposed, it's a variation of transfer learning where you simply repurpose things like MNIST by just feeding all this potentially not useful representations from handwritten digits. And turns out that, you know, single channel of a viral core looks very similar if you project it in a certain way. It looks very similar to a handwritten digit. So data sets are very similar in this case. And that allowed us to sort of avoid the trap of using very high capacity neural nets on relatively shallow data sets.
Just so I'm understanding what you're saying here, are you saying that this single channel, super resolution microscopy imagery, you're able to do some kind of dimensionality reduction or projected into some embedding space and to something that's on the order of an MNIST digit in terms of the number of features, or there's actually something that is like the digits themselves about this data set that you're working with?
It's more coincidental in this case. And it's just the fact that if you work in fluorescence microscopy, there's a lot of tricky technical things that are already done for you as compared to traditional computer vision. So let's say if you have a normal photograph in computer vision, you would need to unmix channels or do some semantic segmentation to avoid to look at foreground versus background. And since those were problems in the field of microscopy for a very long time ago, before we had all these powerful computers and methods, there was a rather simple physical solution sort of developed for this computer science problem, if you will, where fluorescence functional microscopy use the system of specific color illumination and filters to just filter out the light that is not necessary. So you end up with just looking at the foreground on the black background. And that is quite an interesting sort of approach. And it's very, very commonly used, essentially, in microscopy, in fluorescence microscopy. And that's why, you know, when in computer science, people quite often were, you know, trying to develop a very complex solutions to do the segmentations. In biology, people were just like, "Oh, we just used a binning or thresholding, as they call it, to just separate up and down, and we're happy we've got our objects here." So that's there is a difference in mentality in both fields, and I guess that's what I was alluding to in my previous points.
In past conversations, the issues that I tend to hear about that make traditional approaches to like segmentation easy to apply to this microscopy data are things like occlusion, where you've got, you know, whatever your target is, say a virus or a cell, depending on your scale, because you've got these multiple layers, you can have them stacked on each other and things like that. Is the nature of the problem that you are looking at such that, because the viri are so small relative to the cell that you didn't have that those types of occlusion issues to deal with? Or were you, you know, zooming in to able to kind of isolate the individual virus entities, or is there something else happening there?
That's a great question. I'm really glad you asked. So the thing is that in case of viruses, what we're dealing with quite often is a very we are hitting the so-called diffraction limit of in light microscopy. So obviously that would be
definitely. You can't get small enough to properly resolve the virus.
Absolutely. So, and it depends on, it obviously depends on the virus you're working in, but the virus I was working in that particular study was around 450 nanometers in diameter. And that's as close as it gets basically to being slightly above the diffraction limit, which is about 200 nanometers, depending on the wavelength. And basically that allows to exist at this sort of a subpixel, a little bit of a structure resolution, and you would maybe be able to see to see if you get a brighter particle in case it's a cluster of multiple viruses and not. But it's very difficult to get essentially ground truth for that, and we're just moving towards this direction. We're at the limit of diffraction, if you will, in virus light microscopy, and that's why we need techniques like super resolution microscopy, which is not to be confused with super resolution in AI. It's slightly different.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was wondering about whether there was a relationship between the two. Super resolution in AI tends to refer to taking a photo of, you know, a given resolution and making a higher resolution, you know, usually generative version of that. Super resolution microscopy is just talking about using very higher, you know, higher resolution microscopes, or is there more to it than that?
So essentially, on a physical scale, there is no a straightforward way to bypass the or to cross the diffraction limit, and several techniques have been proposed in the past few decades that are extremely interesting and extremely successful at the same time, and they some of them overlap a lot with computational microscopy techniques, where you would essentially try to find sources of information to allow you to cross this limit and compute beyond the diffraction limit. One of sources of such information could be temporal source, where you could try to unmix individual point sources by making molecules blink rather than shine at the same time. Another ways to do that would be to temporarily deplete some of the molecules that are shining and make sure that only few are shining again. So, but essentially the trick of super resolution microscopy, or difficulty of super resolution microscopy, is that there is different information, fundamental information difference between pixel resolution and spatial resolution. So with the spatial resolution, you're trying to understand if you have one pixel, is this one molecule or two molecules? And with pixel resolution, you can happily, you know, create a little bit of structure by doubling the number of pixels and try to do some prediction there. But essentially, if you don't have enough information on whether it's a single molecule or whether it's two molecules or multiple molecules, then you're a little bit in trouble. You don't have enough information. And that's why there are all these clever techniques how to bypass that.
Now, I'm trying to resolve all this conversation we're having about the diffraction limit and things like that with these terribly detailed pictures of the, you know, coronavirus that we're all intimately familiar with now. Is that just a gigantic, massive virus that is easy to resolve? Or, you know, how do we produce these, you know, those images relative to the types of things that we're talking about?
So one of the classic technique, so I would say that light microscopy, the stuff that I've been talking about, is relatively fresh in virology, and sort of a bread and butter technique in virology would be electron microscopy. So electron microscopy, okay. So by using electrons rather than photons, you definitely can bypass the diffraction limit. Okay. And hence you can get this very detailed images of viruses. But the trouble with electron microscopy in general is that it takes a room-sized device and days of sample preparation to do some work there. So
is it also destructive relative to your sample?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So yeah. You definitely cannot do this live. So there is a field in microscopy, in light microscopy, called light microscopy or light cell microscopy, where you just essentially do a video of what's going on in the cell with a different temporal resolution.
Got it. And so this entire project that you are working on was interesting from a life sciences perspective because it was allowing you to resolve things at the level of a virus that were kind of at the edge of what you might be able to do with light microscopes.
Not particularly
impressive for scanning electron microscopes, but just that's a lot more expensive.
And not only that, in terms of, differences in, there are differences in sample preparations, as you said, right? Sample preparation can be destructive, and the entire sort of process of so-called functional microscopy is not as well developed in electron microscopy. By functional microscopy, I mean the situation where you can specifically tag the molecule you're interested in. So in this case, in fluorescence microscopy, you're able to know specifically like, I placed a GFP, which is a green fluorescent protein, in the capsid of a virus, so I know that if I'm seeing some green spot, that's probably the capsid of the virus, and that's what I mean by functional microscopy, and that's a whole new different level of techniques. And I think electron microscopy is trying to get to that level, but it's way trickier.
Got it. So in addition to cost and the sample prep, there's also just stuff that we know how to do with light that we haven't figured out how to do with electrons yet.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. And so is this work that you're referring to the work that was recently accepted in the American Society of Microbiology paper, or is that a different work?
Yeah, that's fresh stuff off the press. Okay.
Awesome. And so you mentioned that paper also looked at the application of capsule networks to this problem. And I mentioned when we were chatting earlier that I think this may be the first time I've heard of capsnets being applied in the wild. tell us a little bit about your experience using capsnets. Why did you try that route, and what kind of results did you see there relative to, CNNs?
Yeah, thanks. Absolutely. So the capsnets, I have to say, they kind of swayed me with the whole sort of elegancy of the idea. So I decided to try them on and just drop some data on it.
And let's not assume that folks are familiar with that. Maybe take a second to what specifically swayed you about the idea there, and what's the idea?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea of having nested representations in capsules and trying to learn the nested representations, I find this somewhat attractive just because you probably would expect some logical connections to be retrieved in such ways. So I decided to try to train a capsule network. And so this turned out to be relatively difficult with absolutely sort of naive architecture without any pre-training. However, using this trick that I've been talking about before, with embedding some amnis data and training it together with, or in a transfer learning sort of setting, with virus data, that helped a lot, and we got pretty good results. ResNets still win, but capsule networks are able to train on even on such wild data, as you mentioned.
Interesting. Yeah. So the way I tend to think about the capsule idea relative to CNNs, and you tell me if this is a horrible explanation or not, is I think of CNNs as being good at kind of this two-dimensional translational invariance, whereas capsule networks are designed to represent kind of the structure within the the thing, the image in multiple, in higher dimensions. Is that the main thing that you find interesting there? Or
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And yeah. I think that's there is something in this idea, because just doing some convolutions and pooling, it's somehow, although it works remarkably well, and I don't mean to say anything about very clear and basic convolutional neural networks. However,
they still outperformed what you
absolutely
ever
yeah. So, but it seems like there should be something more to that. So, you know, I choose to believe.
and you know, when it comes to the ultimate results that you saw, is the idea and kind of what is powering your belief and the promise of CAPSnets, is it that, you know, we with CNNs, and I think you said you use ResNets, like we know how to scale the compute there, and, you know, CAPSnets, they're newer, maybe we don't know how to scale the compute as well and make networks that are as deep, but fundamentally, if we could do with CAPSnets what we are able to do now with ResNets, you would expect it to perform better. Is it that kind of thing where, you know, we're just kind of catching up in our ability to compute? I'm trying to really get at the thing that you think holds, you know, holds so much promise, given that it, you know, isn't working as well.
Yeah, so I hope that exactly as you suggested, you know, if we're able to scale the sort of network capacity required to address certain problems, we'll get them to work a little bit better than they do at the moment. And in principle, maybe it's not the capsule networks in general that will work out in the end. Maybe it is also some other approach that will build upon this premise that, you know, there's more of a context that we need to try to include in multiple levels at the same time.
Is your work touching on kind of this inherent graphical nature of the underlying biological systems at all? Is that something that you look at?
Not yet. Unfortunately, we didn't have sort of capacity to look at this aspect. But I certainly think that, you know, there is only that many questions you can answer with a binary classification problem, right? So there is definitely a necessity to go deeper into representing the knowledge that is contained in the massive bodies of biomedical literature, for example, to try to understand the complexity within that we have in the data. I mean, from the point of from probably the very first day when I started working with microscopy images, I always perceived it as a sort of a ultimate Rorschach test, if you will. It's you get a spot like a white spot or grayscale spot in a black background, and you're trying to understand what is that thing. And different people would definitely see different things in the same image. One person would be like, oh, what is that thing? Oh, somebody told me that's a cell nucleus. And another person will see chromatin there, and a cell is about to divide. And, you know, there's a lot of information that depends on the context and depends on your prior knowledge there. So obviously, as you said, I think as incorporating things like knowledge graphs into work like this would be definitely a way forward. And that's something that I see developing in the coming years in the field.
And so maybe using that as an opportunity to zoom back out to AI and life sciences generally, we spend a lot of time talking about microscopy, and that plays a big role in the field. Has your organization, you know, made any attempts to kind of map out the various ways that AI, you know, can or should impact life sciences, and how far along we are in those various areas?
That would be a thing to go for that we have already discussed with my colleagues, and unfortunately, we haven't had that much time to do that just yet. But I think in general, you know, going beyond just microscopy and images, looking at there's a lot of research going on right now in the field of molecular life sciences in general, looking at the molecular structures or sequences, protein sequences, DNA sequences, and trying to combine it with basic techniques like same that is used in the fields of natural language processing, for example, right? Where you could try to use some generative approaches, for example, to see or to predict the binding sites and to predict novel conformations of molecules and so on. So this is definitely a great direction to start getting into. And I guess the way I see the mission for the organization is that we should try to bring the conversation forward to combining similar to the way that life sciences are structured today. We need to combine multiple sources of information revolving around similar phenomena in order to be able to push the discovery, because discovering life sciences is never done as a result of single sort of method that shows one thing. You always need to reach out and try to prove or disprove your concepts using multiple methodologies, and look at things from multiple sides.
And is that fundamentally because where the real insights are in life sciences is when we start to understand function, and you don't just kind of see that in a one shot thing. It's based around a developing body of knowledge that comes from looking at things in different angles?
Absolutely. So the thing is that most discoveries are made not because you see something unusual and that's a discovery. It's quite in contrary. It's a rigorous process of just trying to disprove that you made a discovery, essentially, in multiple ways until you run out of ways to disprove yourself. So I remember when I stumbled upon a virus inhibitor which we published in 2017. It was using biomedical imaging, time-lapse imaging of so-called virus plaques. Virus plaques are when you start your infection with one single cell, it shines green, and then you see that the infection is spreading to neighboring cells, and you get an idea what's going on with those cells. Are they supporting the infection spread or not? And I couldn't get it to work under certain conditions, and it turned out that one of the molecules I was keeping in my medium was preventing it from spreading, and that's how you stumble upon a discovery. But essentially, to get from that point to the actual published paper, it took a collaboration of multiple people and multiple methodologies to address multiple aspects of what's going on.
Yeah, to what degree are there hobbyist opportunities in life sciences? Like, do you have to have the backing of a huge lab to not necessarily make interesting discoveries, but even play with the data? Or are there things that folks can do to just start to better understand biology with the tools that we have in neural networks and the data sets that have been made available?
That's an excellent question. Thanks a lot. So actually, I believe personally that there are massive amounts of hobbyist opportunities scattered around the field. There is simply not enough hands in life sciences to get all this advanced methodologies going and doing what they can do best, like fostering science, improving the accuracy of assays, and so on. So I think that that's one of the sort of main missions of the organization I'm trying to build. It's to bring together hobbyist researchers from all sorts of fields in order to see, maybe there is a opportunity to publish paper here and there, and maybe there is an opportunity to make advances in virology. Maybe there is an opportunity to just get some published data and play with it a little bit. So that's one of the goals of this work. And in principle, there is really a lot of data sources that maybe not many people know about that they can immediately work with from a public domain. And there are a lot of open problems. We just need hands.
Awesome. And so for folks that are interested in taking you up on that, How do they find you, connect with you, learn more about the opportunities that are out there?
Go to ALS.institute and join the forum, start a conversation, ask a question. And the idea is that we will connect you with researchers who are actively working in this.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Arthur, thanks so much for taking the time to share a bit about what you're up to. Very cool stuff.
Thanks a lot, Sam. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you. All right, everyone. That's our show for today. To learn more about today's guest or the topics mentioned in this interview, visit twimmelai.com. Of course, if you like what you hear on the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. Thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.